Hi, I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And I'm Maya Garant.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
Guys, today we're going to go back. We're going to go back in time.
To the 80s and 90s, maybe even all the way back to the 70s. We're going to look at TV shows from our youth that featured strong, sassy, independent women as the main characters.
And we're doing this because we were inspired by Linda Bloodworth Thomason's article this week about her relationship with Les Moonves and what happened to her career. And it put us back in time to realizing that actually, as young women, we had great role models on very mainstream TV.
Yes, Linda Bloodworth Thomason created Designing Women. So we want to dive into that. Before we get into that, we're going to do a few updates. Then we'll jump in and talk about the white feminists of our youth. So Maya, how are you doing today and what are you drinking?
Well, look, I really want to share with everybody because I'm really proud of this. I've been so behind on my whole life. And this week I was seized by a fever and I have gone through my email inbox and I have gotten my email inbox down to 105 emails.
That must feel amazing.
It feels amazing.
Isn't it the best?
It feels really good. I am drinking. I finally got my hands on some rum.
Yay.
And I'm drinking a Mount Gay and Tonic. Mount Gay is a very kind of creamy rum. It has a very specific taste and it pairs very nicely with a little tonic water and some lime.
That sounds nice. I am drinking a sour cocktail that I envisioned and created all
in a dream. In a fever dream?
In a fever dream of cocktail inspiration. I wanted to make a sour because it usually is made with egg white. And I love foamy egg whites in a cocktail. But I also didn't want to put sugar. And sours are usually made with lemon juice and sugar. So I had the idea to use spiced rum and Cointreau instead of sugar with lemon juice and egg white. It's okay. It's foamy. I like the foam. I don't know if I'll make it again. But it's definitely drinkable.
Now, I want to just share this one email that somehow I don't think we ever shared. It was from June.
Okay.
And it's so beautiful. It's from one of our listeners, from Dean Madden. He suggested some things that we're going to get into, you know, later. Mm-hmm. But he said, last but far from least, there's this, the sauce. You've enlightened, enraptured, and entertained me through some of the toughest times I've experienced. Thanks for helping to open my eyes. Thanks for helping to broaden my perspective. Thanks for helping me on the journey to be better than I was before. Your knowledge and insight has been an extraordinary source of understanding as well as an inspiration to be better. My thanks for these past and future episodes.
That is so lovely.
Right?
That's really
God,
nice.
That's
it
so
makes me
nice.
Feel like we're doing good work.
I know.
We're helping people. Not just talking out our asses every week.
I know. It's so nice. I'm so touched by that. So if you guys have been similarly moved, please email us because we need it. It keeps us going. Thank you,
exactly.
Dean. That's really, really moving because this helps us get into some updates.
Okay.
We got a comment from @DLA Commentary. Mm-hmm. And DLA Commentary is talking about our episode about forgiving men. And says, I'm very glad I listened to this conversation because I was starting to feel like I'm going crazy because other people seem so ready to forgive bad actors without any actual change in their behavior. And I'm sitting here like, am I bad for not forgiving? And it says, this is particularly relevant when it comes to the 2016 election and the voting habits of certain people in my life. I'm not ready to forgive people who are going to turn around and do it again. I need to know they've learned and changed. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yes, what an interesting connection.
Thanks so much for
writing. Yes. Yeah. An interesting new angle on that whole topic of forgiving men or forgiving people in general. It's like, can or should you forgive people for their bad political actions, especially when they're not sorry for them? Because they rarely are.
They really are. And it's hard when we see the impact that it's had on people. Like, that's what we're talking about in terms of this weird public forgiveness of Debbie at McCain's funeral he's responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people across the world. You're like, wow, I can't. Why are these people forgiving him? This is kind of unforgivable. But also what's interesting is that we put out the Forgiving Men episode not knowing, but perhaps knowing in a deeper way that this week there were going to be two essays coming out where major Me Too targets, people who Me Too took
culprits,
down.
John, one might
culprits,
say.
Culprits. That's the best word. Both from the radio world. Gian Gomeshi, who's a CBC kind of music bad boy, Russell Brand music guy of Canada, and John Hockenberry from WNYC, who last year came under scrutiny or their systemic harassment of women was made public. Mm-hmm. And John Hockenberry in Harper's and Gian Gomeshi in the New York Review of Books each came out this week with multi-thousand word essays about why they're not such bad guys.
Yeah. Not even an apology. Like,
no.
Not even to the level where they're asking for forgiveness by owning what they did. They're not
even
owning it.
They're talking about how they might have been transformed by having their bad behavior made public. Like, I've been on this really difficult journey of getting to know myself and saying, who am I that I would treat women that way? Why in these intimate moments do I feel like I need to take power in this way? Like, oh gosh, the women that I harassed always end up being subordinates. What's that about? Like, there's no... That we saw the guy, Dan Harmon from Community. Like, his public... apology was very much about him saying, I'm asking myself these really difficult questions about who I am and why I behave this way. There's none of that. There's none of that. And I think another one of the things where it's like, has Me Too gone too far? One of the things that these essays are purporting to say is like, what is it like to have been the Me Too guy?
Yeah.
And you know what it's like? It's like somebody who hasn't learned anything.
Yeah, that's what drove me so nuts about these two pieces is like, I know what those guys are going to say. They don't think they did anything wrong. Duh. And they're going to defend themselves and say they didn't do shit wrong. And the problem I have with it is that these publications would see fit to publish that.
I also have to say, don't click on their shit.
Oh,
there
please
are people
don't.
Who put PDFs up there so that Harper's and NYRB doesn't get the clicks. But I will say, go click on Isaac Chatimer, who's a writer for Slate, interviewed the editor of the New York Review of Books being like, what the fuck was up with the Gian Gomeshi essay? And it's a really amazing interview. And the editor is really like, I don't know. I didn't know that he punched women. I didn't know that. Punching could be, things are different. You know, sometimes biting is aggressive and sometimes it means something fun and sexy. And you're like, wow,
oh,
like
God.
You really didn't think this through.
Yeah.
And what was very interesting is that when Isaac says in the interview, like, you know, what did the editorial staff think about this? Was there a gender divide? And he said there was a generational divide, which probably also means there's a gender divide because probably the older editors are probably men. But he said it was over 40 and under 40, and that the younger editors were like, no. And the older editors were like, what? This guy, he was acquitted. Part of his acquittal was him admitting to him doing wrong and apologizing publicly.
Right.
Gian Gomeshi did abuse these women and publicly admitted to abusing these women. He punched women. He choked women. He sexually harassed women. 20 women came forward. 20. If you want like the guy for this kind of article, find some guy for whom like one woman said something bad. Don't like find the guy that's a fucking army of 20 women being like, yeah, everybody knew about this.
Yeah, or find the guy who actually is introspective and repentant and has something to say about what he's learned, or find the woman or women who want to talk about what they've been through, or men who've been harassed, who've been abused, and can talk about how it affected their lives and their careers.
And yeah, that's right. And I feel like Norm MacDonald, we're going to have to mention.
We have to talk about this.
So Norm MacDonald, the comedian, who is known for just being some white guy asshole, it's like not anything surprising, says that he managed to get Louis C.K. to call Roseanne after she lost her show. And he said, you know, whatever with these victims, but they don't know what it's like to lose everything.
Lose everything in one day.
Yeah, they lost everything in one day.
Yeah, as if Louis C.K. wasn't jacking off in front of women for years and years.
And as if Roseanne hadn't been writing fucking racist, crazy pants shit for years.
Transphobic shit.
Yeah, crazy, crazy. Not even right wing. That's where you start calling it just like wingnut crazy shit.
Out there, but horribly offensive. Yeah, she's been doing that for ages. And what happened in one day is that it came to a head. The story came out, or the straw that broke the camel's back happened in Roseanne's case. And they have to deal with the consequences of what they fucking did.
But what's behind it? It's the same thing that we talked about in an earlier episode about political correctness and free speech.
Oh, yeah.
This idea that all of these libs aren't allowing people to speak freely. Mm-hmm. You know, they can say whatever they want. We can all call it bullshit. That's our free speech right, is to say we think you're full of shit.
Right.
When people like this feel the weight of discourse saying we don't agree, mm-hmm. it's like they never take the time to go, oh, this must be what women often feel like. This must be what Black people often feel like. They're all of a sudden like, they're like, this is horrible. You're like, oh yeah, you think? Yeah. It sucks when you say something and absolutely no one agrees with you. That sucks. That does suck.
Yeah. It sucks when people are like, well, you're not allowed to have a TV show because we don't like your kind, having your kind on our network. Yeah. You think other people might know what that feels like, and maybe for things that they couldn't control in the first place and just who they are. No one makes that connection.
There's no moment where they say, let me put myself in the other person's shoes.
No, it's look what's happening to me. And even with the Norm MacDonald thing, he's identifying with Roseanne and Louis C.K. Mm-hmm. It's all very one-sided, which is why it pisses me off that the publications would bother to print that shit. I don't care what those people have to say. There are so many other ways of framing these issues, but just by the fact of you printing it, you are framing the conversation. Now people have to look at what Norm MacDonald said and agree with it, disagree with it, explain why it's wrong, explain why they think it's right or he has a point. And it's like, that shouldn't have been the framework we were talking about in the first place, because it's centered on the accused people and full of misunderstandings, misapprehensions about the situation. So you're busy focusing on the accused and correcting people's misapprehensions instead of moving forward with like all the stuff we talked about in the redemption episode about like asking how we can make the situation better and safer and more inclusive. Mm. Mm. And then, of course, the big news of recent days.
Oh, my God, guys. It's like, I was saying something to Nikki, my best friend Nikki, and she was like, I hear mandolins playing in the background. The sort of continued mafia saga that is our current administration.
Well, Paul Manafort has made a plea deal with Robert Mueller. I feel like we are, if not already in it, about to enter the third act of Goodfellas.
Yes, we totally are. And here's the thing. This is my favorite part about the plea deal that I didn't even think about until Josh Marshall was writing about it on Talking Points Memo. Because the whole week leading up to it, it was in the news that Manafort was trying to negotiate something. Okay?
Yeah.
But we know that Mueller's team doesn't leak. If there's anything that is ever in the news about mm-hmm. the Mueller investigation, it is never from the Mueller team. So in all of the articles leading up to the day that Manafort went into court, it was like, he's not cooperating. He's not cooperating. He is standing tall, as the mafia/Donald Trump would say. And then it turns out he is fully cooperating, which means that Manafort's team that was leaking to the press was leaking false information so that the Trump team wouldn't know that Manafort was cooperating till the moment that he was in trial. That shit is crazy. Also, Manafort has agreed to talk to the investigators without his lawyers present, without his counsel
really?
Present.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, he's given them everything.
Yeah.
His back was up against the wall. And I think it's really interesting because I don't know what changed for him where he knew he had these charges against him. He knew what the evidence was against him. And he was like standing tall, like he thought Trump was going to pardon him or that whatever was going to happen, it was going to be fine. Then after that guilty verdict in his first trial, pretty shortly after that, he was starting to be in talks with Mueller's people. And I have to wonder whether he got some signal like Trump is not your man.
Yeah.
You can't count on him. Like what happened? Or if it was just like the reality smacked him in the face where he was like, oh shit, I'm going to die in jail.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to roll the dice and take the chances on Trump fixing it for him, which I don't blame him for. But when you cooperate, like it's not a great deal for him. He still has to plead guilty and he's still going to be sentenced. He's still going to go to prison. And he has to give up everything. Like, he just has to spill everything.
Well, he was in a stronger position to negotiate a year ago when the Mueller team didn't have as much information. And he could say, I can talk up to here. But I think at this point, the Mueller investigation has put together enough that he really has to give a lot
for
cooperation to be meaningful for them. And part of what they've agreed to is that the 10 charges that the jury was hung on in the Virginia trial get to get sort of surrendered. So
they're
anyway,
not going to retry him on those.
They're not going to retry him on those. He's so fucked. So we'll see what happens in the third act of Goodfellas. But I feel like, wow.
happens is all the gangsters who thought they were above the law and were so much better than the regular chump working for a living all wind up either becoming state's witness or dead.
Roxane Gay this week said, hey, you know, they've given 7,000 words to Hockenberry and Gian Gomeshi. When are they going to give 7,000 words to the victims?
Mm.
And that is true. But actually, there were many, many words given to one of Les Moonves's sort of victims, a woman whose career was laid victim by Les Moonves, the guy who was the head of CBS, who just resigned. Her career was sacrificed at the altar of his misogyny. And this is the TV producer, Linda Bloodworth Thomason. Linda Bloodworth Thomason was at the peak of her career. She had done the show Evening Shade, which was like this big show. She had a $50 million contract with CBS. And she had this very big show called Designing Women, which was sort of based on her life. It's about these four Southern ladies in Atlanta who run a design, interior design business, these four sort of saucy ladies. So she was riding high. And then Les Moonves was hired as the head of CBS, and she never made another show, and she didn't work for 7 years.
Yeah.
You should go see it. The article is in The Hollywood Reporter. It is brilliantly written, as you might expect from somebody who wrote some of the most successful sitcoms of all time. It's brutal. Mm-hmm. And it's brutal about what happened to her career. And it's brutal towards Les Moonves. And I love the way it opens where she's like, this is not going to be what is the word that she uses? Like, it's not going to be like gentle. It's going to be petty and punishing. It's not going to be gracious. It's going to be petty and punishing. It's an extraordinary piece. And one of the things that she notes that made us think about this week is that after he came to CBS, there were all of these strong women shows on CBS.
Mm-hmm.
And in the hallway, in sort of the main hallway, there were the pictures of all of the big stars of all the shows.
Right.
And she noticed over the 7 years that she was there, a lot of the women who were part of these strong women badass shows disappeared off the walls and were replaced with like shows like Two and a Half Men and shows that were sort of male focused where women aren't there.
Mm-hmm. So we wanted to kind of talk about some of those female focused shows that were formative for us in shaping our view of women's place in the world and who and what we could be.
And I have to say, I didn't know CBS was the home of Mary Tyler Moore and Rhoda and Maude Murphy Brown.
Oh,
so
wow.
It had been the place for these kinds of shows. The best line in the whole thing is that thanks to Les Moonves, I can only guess they all became vaginal swabs in the crime labs on CSI Amarillo. For years, Moonves loaded up the network with highly profitable male-dominated series, but mostly he presided over a plethora of macho crime shows featuring a virtual genocide of dead naked hotties in morgue drawers with sadistic female autopsy reports ratcheted up each week. Is that a missing breast implant, Lieutenant? Yes, sir. We also found playing cards in her uterus.
Oh, but it's true. I mean, those shows got replaced by the CSI type shows. What I'd like to do is look back at Murphy Brown and Designing Women and some of those shows that featured these independent, saucy, sassy women. So are we going to go in chronological order?
Yes. So the shows of our youth were predated and they were part of a larger arc and trend that began in the 70s where, look, a sitcom is a situation comedy. It's looking for a situation.
Yes.
That's like an inherently kind of crazy, funny situation in which a lot of hijinks can happen, right?
Yeah.
So the situation of Women's Lib inspired a lot of comedies that led to the sitcoms of our youth. So in the 70s, we had Mary Tyler Moore and Rhoda. Rhoda was a spinoff of Mary Tyler Moore. And those were like the challenges of a working gal. Trying to make it in this new world where now working gals are part of the world. Yeah, they're young. They're working. Ooh.
Yeah. And Mary Tyler Moore was like, it was a great workplace comedy sitcom where Rhoda was the more cynical friend of hers. So it had, she had a little bit more of an edge.
She was the Jewish one.
Yeah, exactly.
The Mary Tyler Moore show is very like nice waspy girl.
It's very
and there
waspy.
Was that sharp tongued Jewish girl, kind of like us. And
I think
she
we
was
can
such
relate.
A hit. Yeah.
There was also Maude.
Oh yeah.
That was with Bea Arthur.
Mm-hmm. And it's very famous because it was like Bea Arthur, there's an abortion episode.
Yes.
Where Bea Arthur, who's like middle-aged in a marriage,
yeah.
gets pregnant around the time when she thinks she's like, you know, going
done
through menopause
that kind
or whatever.
Of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And she gets an abortion and it's no big fucking deal.
Right, right. There was also a show that I loved and watched the shit out of, which is One Day at a Time.
Oh, yeah.
That was, I think, more late 70s.
It was.
And went into the early 80s. That was a show about a single mom and her two teenage daughters. Like, she had been divorced and was trying to raise these daughters as a single mom. And at the time, I think it was very innovative. This woman making it on her own.
Yeah. A divorcee.
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah. And the struggles and difficulties of that, but also, you know, the joys of it and the liberation possible from it. It was very of its moment, I think.
God, you know what else goes with that? And it goes in, we'll talk about it later. Laverne and Shirley.
Oh, shit. Yeah, for sure. Laverne and Shirley is a fascinating one.
But it's part of more of the like working class that we're going to get into later. Like, I didn't even think about that. But that's, so it's like part of a situation where I think it was exciting for all of a sudden women who were not like moms and not like the married sort of like their
Donna
only
Reed.
Figure was there as the wife. They're like women with jobs and hopes and dreams and sex lives.
Yeah.
I feel like Maude, where it's like a middle-aged woman who's married who still fucks her husband, it's like you never see that now.
Right?
You know what I mean? And where she's the star. He's the side character. It's about her.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd have to really think about it. And I'll be frank, I don't really watch network sitcoms and I haven't in a while. So I'm not sure what's out there.
That's true.
I also think if you look on like Netflix and Amazon and HBO and places that are doing more interesting things, you'll see more interesting stuff like that. But off the top of my head, it's hard for me to think of a show, particularly a half-hour sitcom, that centers on like a middle-aged woman.
Yeah. 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 But in the 80s, there were tons of them, middle-aged and older women. You had Kate and Allie, which I loved that show.
Yeah, I loved it. So Kate and Allie was about these two, were they divorcees?
Yeah, they were both divorced. They were like best friends.
Okay.
They both end up divorced. They both have kids. And they're like, let's just live together and like fucking figure out our lives. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's building on the one day at a time thing, but now they're best friends. And I mean, it was so long ago, but didn't it have a kind of like an odd couple thing to it? They like had different personalities.
Totally. And you know who was in it, who I love, was Jane Curtin.
Oh, of course.
And she played this sort of uptight character. And she was sort of this housewife, this sort of Connecticut housewife, whose husband divorces her for this younger woman. And so she sort of is the housewife in the pair.
Yes.
Oh, it was so good. It was so good. And what was great about it was that it was like they were the center of everything. There were no men in that show. The men were so
peripheral.
On the side. Yeah. They were so peripheral.
Totally.
And then you have the Golden Girls, like retirees. Like, when would that ever happen? If you were like, I want to make a show about four old ladies in a retirement community in Florida,
right?
Who are off like fucking and like figuring out their life. Like,
it's actually amazing to me that show got made, but it was great. And part of what made it work was that you had these four different characters and they each were so well defined. Blanche was the slutty one and Rose was the sort of dingbat.
Yeah, she's the dumb one. The dumb one.
And who is Bea Arthur's character? Dorothy.
Dorothy was like the straight woman.
She was kind of the straight woman, but she was also kind of sarcastic.
Yeah, very dry.
Very dry. Very dry. Very dry. And then there was her mom, played by Estelle Getty.
Oh, God.
Who was like...
so good.
Who always had the smart ass remark for everything. They were dating men. They were fucking men. They were... living their lives.
Getting into all kinds of hijinks.
Yeah, situations and stuff. And it's like, when do you see that on TV or anywhere? When do you see elder women, like women over 60?
And I feel like a big part of that was that you got to see these women who would like live their lives so they knew shit. You know what I mean? The fact that they were experienced was part of what made their hijinks sort of fabulous, because they kind of knew what they were doing. They weren't apologizing for anything. And they were kind of managing their lives. Oh, so great. I mean,
I
clearly it had this deep inspiration. There's like a drag queen show where they like do Golden Girls, like drag episodes of Golden Girls. The next time you're in LA, I'll take you. It's really good.
I will definitely go with you to see that. And even in an episode of Queer Eye, while they're waiting for the makeover subject to come out in his new clothes, they're deciding which Golden Girl each of them are. You know, like people do with Sex and the City, I'm a Carrie.
Yeah.
They were like doing that with Golden Girls.
It makes me realize how much these people predated, like you couldn't have had Sex in the City
without
the Golden Girls.
They're the same show.
They're the same show.
They're the same show.
So then you have Designing Women, which was Linda Bloodworth Thomason's show. And these are like four women who were working in what is acceptably women's work, right? They're like, they're interior designers.
Design,
it's not like they're sitting there being like lawyers, but
they're running their own business.
They are running their own business, and they have that thing about like Southern women. Oh God, there's this joke. This is like my favorite Southern. I lived in rural Mississippi for 2 years. This is my favorite joke that I learned about Southern women when I was there, about how there's like Maybeth and Luann, and they're sitting there talking, and Maybeth says, Luann, my husband gave me this emerald ring for having my first child. And Luann says, oh, that's nice. And then Mary Beth says, and then my husband is so sweet. He gave me the sapphire necklace for having my second child. And Luann says, oh, that's nice. And Mary Beth says, Luann, what does your husband do for you? And Luann says, well, my husband sent me to charm school. And Mary Beth says, charm school? And Luann says, yeah. So instead of saying, fuck you, I say, oh, that's nice.
That like really encapsulates the whole ethos behind designing women.
Where it's like, it's brutal, it's sharp, where it's like this layer of sugar on top a knife.
Yeah.
That was the sort of pleasure of designing women, was seeing these like razor sharp fucking motherfuckers. Like, they cut you. You know
what I mean? Yeah.
But with this layer of sugar on top, but you're never fooled by it. Like, you know that they're badass.
Right.
It's almost like Little Women. Like, there are four of them. And they each kind of have these personalities. Oh, you know what was the earlier, like, the young girl version of this was One Day at a Time. Or not One Day at a Time. With Joe and Blair.
Oh, my God. The Facts of Life.
The Facts of Life. The Facts of Life. That was like the young girl version of it. There were no men in Facts of Life.
True. Like, that's kind of true. I feel that. Yeah. And you had Joe, but also obviously so influenced by Little Women. She was called Joe, and she was like the tomboy tough one. When the show found its footing is when they had the four girls, right? When it was Joe and Blair and Tootie and Natalie. Yeah. And that also mirrors Golden Girls and Sex and the City. That's kind of interesting now that I'm thinking about it. This pattern of shows that have the four women, maybe it all does stem from Little Women.
I think it's, and look, right now, Issa Rae's Insecure. Like, there's Issa and there's her best friend Molly, but their bigger crew is four women. Huh. And one of the things is that they all get to sort of hold a position in terms of points of view. But they're really good friends. And even though sometimes they come into tension with each other, and oftentimes they come into tension with each other, there is no ending of the friendship. There is always love there. And there's like this little community there. And it's very like intense. It's very full of love.
Yeah. There's something very feministic about that, too. It's very much about women supporting each other, not turning to men for their financial needs, not turning to men for their emotional needs, which takes us to the topic of, like, the feminism of these shows.
Oh, yeah. These shows were deeply feminist, and for all the reasons that you just mentioned. Like, men are peripheral. Men are there for pleasure. But men are not, it's actually all of these shows pass the Bechdel test. Like Alison Bechdel, like to watch out for. The Bechdel test for a movie is there a scene of two women?
Yeah, two named characters.
Two named characters having a conversation with each other about something other than a man. And with all of these shows, it's all the time.
Yeah.
Like, these women are supporting each other. They love each other. They talk shit about each other and they know each other's weaknesses. But that in some ways only supports their friendship even more.
Yeah. It's very much about that sort of empowerment via networks of relationships with other women.
Yes.
I mean, Designing Women actually got pretty explicit. They would have the character, well, the main character, Julia Sugarbaker, that was her name, right? Would just go on rants.
They had an entire episode, and actually Linda Bloodworth Thomason talks about this. They had an entire episode about the Clarence Thomas nomination. Like,
And the Anita Hill accusations. Yeah. And that's kind of one of the outstanding things I remember from that show is a lot of her kind of like, for lack of a better word, soapboxing, but it was entertaining. It was written and performed in an entertaining way where she was like, I'm not going to put up with this because blah, 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 blah. And you're like, you say it, Southern lady.
Yes. but also the professional thing was huge with a show that had a huge impact on me, which was Murphy Brown.
Oh, my God. I loved Murphy Brown.
Oh, my God. So Murphy Brown is about this sort of TV show that's very much like a 60 Minutes TV show, FYI. And Murphy Brown is sort of the big journalist on it. And the show starts when she's like, comes back from the Betty Ford Clinic. She's like an alcoholic. She's like an addict. And mm-hmm. she sort of goes, dries out, and comes back. And what's amazing about that show that I think also reflects back on all of these female characters, I think there's a way in more sexist shows where like the women have less power and they also have fewer faults. They're like, oh, they're like the good wife who's always like, honey, gosh.
Yeah.
And all of the women in all of these shows have deep flaws. And that's fine. There is no problem with that.
That is so true. Murphy Brown, for me, I remember watching that as a kid and it being one of the first shows that I felt like I was watching an adult show. I was watching a show for grownups.
Oh, yeah.
I felt sophisticated watching Murphy Brown.
Absolutely. Murphy Brown was one of those shows that kind of raises the level of the viewer because you get to be the insider of these characters who are intelligent, intellectual, like, right. And you're on their side. So you are elevated by that.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the jokes I will never forget, there's this episode about this sort of younger girl who comes in. And she's like, she's young and she thinks she knows more. Mm-hmm. And at the end, Murphy Brown kind of like puts her in her place and is like, I've done this and I've done that and I've interviewed this person and I have an orgasm every time I have sex. And the young woman is like, really? I will never forget this. I haven't seen this in 30 years. The young woman is like, yeah, I heard the rest of what you said because that was a speech you made at my journalism school, but you really have an orgasm every time because I don't. And I remember being like, wow. Like there is a way in which being an older woman, being an experienced older woman is never undermined. Like when the younger women get more attention, the comedy is about how stupid that is.
Yeah.
The comedy is not about how old and ugly the older woman is.
Right. Yeah. And I do think we can't go without mentioning that Murphy Brown came into like the show that was sort of about news and politics came into the real news when the character Murphy Brown, who was single, had a baby, and Vice President at the time, Dan Quayle, felt compelled to comment about it as like an example of the degradation of American society and the glorification
of American family. Yeah.
The glorification of single motherhood. And gosh, and thus the culture wars were birthed.
Right.
For me, as an early adolescent, it sort of like was a moment where I was able to really identify myself on one side of that culture war, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, no, it's okay. It's okay for women to have babies if they're not married. That's fine. And like, in fact, it's good that the show is depicting that and not judging it because it's a reality for a lot of women and it's fine.
I was once hired to do this gig at a high school. And I remember that the teacher said, high school students are just looking for an adult that the idea of being like that adult makes them not want to kill themselves.
That's really apt. I like that.
And to me, Murphy Brown was like that figure. Like the idea that I was going to grow up and be like her or be like one of the sugar bakers or be like Kate, like it made me not want to like kill myself.
Right.
And briefly, I do want to mention the thing about designing women in Murphy Brown and all of these things is that they were very like professional. These were like high professional, educated, like elevated in that way. There were also working class versions of this. In the 70s, there were shows Laverne and Shirley. There was the show Alice, which is about this waitress working in this restaurant. There was the Carol Burnett spinoff from her show Mama's Family, which was like amazing. And then there was Roseanne. And Roseanne was happening at the same time as this. Roseanne was like the blue collar alternative to Murphy Brown because the initial iteration of Roseanne was very powerful in that she was the center of the family.
Mm-hmm.
She was a badass. She was dry about it. She wasn't doing things to make people like feel good. She was just trying to get by and she was smart as fucking hell.
Oh, yeah.
That's part of why Roseanne in her rich, crazy iteration is very painful because she was incredibly inspiring. And even when she was out there publicly, like just pissing people off as who she was as a public celebrity, that meant a lot to me as a woman coming up because she didn't give a fuck.
That was also a favorite show. And I remember that at the time when Roseanne came out, The Cosby Show was really like the big hit sitcom at the time. And Roseanne provided this really wonderful alternative because Cosby Show, they were upper middle class, two professional parents living in a lovely brownstone in, Brooklyn
That's
Heights.
Right.
And that went actually a long way toward reframing a lot of Americans' perception of race. So, you know, good on that show for what it did. But Roseanne was offering this like, no, that's not really the American experience, though.
That's right.
This is a working class kind of quote unquote regular family. This is a middle class, lower middle class family. And these are the struggles that we have.
Where everything kind of goes wrong.
Like, yeah, shit goes wrong. All the time. Life was tough for them. Like, you could see how the Connors were struggling, but there was this deep undercurrent of like love for each other and togetherness, but not in a la-di-da fantasy way, in a realistic family way that was very relatable and had an edge to it and, like you said, an intelligence to it. It was a smart show.
It was a smart show with smart characters. And what was great was that being smart doesn't mean your life is not hard. And I think that that's pretty radical. Like, you can be smart and trying to work it out and seeing where shit is going wrong, and your life can still be hard. So there were all of these shows that presented this kind of like feminism, this badass feminism, this feminism that women who didn't look like some fucking model are out there living, working, fucking.
Making it happen.
Making it happen for themselves. All of this was there. And yet, there are limits to this kind of feminism that was being promoted.
As influential as these shows were on us, as inspired as we were by the strong, independent women doing their own thing, and it really helped us see a future for ourselves that we could live with. Years later, we're able to look back and say, there were some shortcomings to this version of feminism.
Yeah.
So I think a good place to start is to note that all of these women were white.
Yes. They were.
They were all white. They were all straight, as far as I recall.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah. What we'd now call intersectionality was completely missing. There were shows that depicted different class struggles, but not usually within the same show. You didn't see Murphy Brown dealing with class issues at all.
Not really, no.
And aside from them being just completely white, there was also even within them sometimes issues like on Designing Women, if I recall correctly, Delta Burke's character, one of the ongoing gags was she had like a Latina maid named, I want to say Consuela.
Oh, God.
But I'm forgetting.
Oh, God.
But yeah. Like, I thought it was very funny at the time. As a kid, it seemed very funny. But looking back, I'm like, oh, Jesus. Ooh, that's not funny.
And I feel like there's that thing with like Murphy Brown, this way that she was so white, but she is signaled as cool by her love of black music.
Yeah.
And there's this way in which dealing with race in this like deep way, deep, deep, deep way is not actually dealt with. But it's signaled, we're like, I like black music. I don't like racist people, but that's as far as it goes.
Yeah.
I am awesome. I am not racist. But there were no like regular black characters. All the main characters were white.
Right. I wouldn't even say they dealt with race in a surface way. Like, they just didn't really deal with it at all. They just signaled to you like, this person is down. This person is cool. She's not racist.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Although on Designing Women, there was a black character and a gay character.
Yeah.
He was coded as gay. I don't think they ever, boy, someone who's a better expert on Designing Women can tell me if they ever explicitly gave any signal like of him dating a man or anything like that. But he was very coded as gay.
Right, right. It's the difference between radical feminism, mm-hmm. you were bringing this up, and liberal feminism.
I do feel like these shows were extremely heavily influenced by the liberal feminism of the 60s and 70s. And for listeners who may not be familiar with these terms, these are women's studies terms. The liberal feminism refers to the type of feminism that sort of sought to gain equality for women within the existing structures.
Right.
If men can work, women should be able to work. If men get paid a certain amount, women should get paid the same amount. It didn't critique those structures or seek to reform them in any radical way. Radical right. meaning at the root. So very much liberal in like the 17th century sense, like
right.
individual freedom and egalitarianism.
Right.
And that really was kind of like, I feel like that's the feminism that pop culture picked up in the 70s and 80s. That was the feminism that led to these shows. The whole conceptualizing of these women's needs, it just seems very, very influenced by that kind of liberal feminism, by that kind of like second wave type of feminism, which is like women should be allowed to work if they want. Sexism is bad.
It's not about changing the system. It's about women getting to win in the system. And generally it means white women get to win in the system.
Yeah. And I want to add that very explicitly it means that, because in the 60s and 70s, there absolutely were black women and gay women and other, you know, disabled women who were saying, you know, what about us? Can we talk yes. about lesbians? Can we talk about what yes. we need?
And yes.
absolutely the white women who were dominating the mainstream feminist movement were saying, not right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Us first.
In fact, can you kind of step behind these other ladies yes. so you don't get seen, because it's going to damage.
Yeah, just
people aren't going to go for that yeah. right now. People aren't going to go for it. It's going to ruin everything for us. Like, that was a thing.
Another version of that I remember talking to this one woman. She's an artist. She was in her 80s. And I remember her saying to me, the difference between American feminism and, say, like French feminism. She said French feminists fought for what they knew they'd need, like childcare and healthcare. And American feminists fought for the right to be like men. And that's like another sort of version of it. Like, I want to get to be powerful, not I want to change how power is structured.
And I think we see the shortcomings of that now a lot. Like, number one, we see it in that there's not just a wage gap between men and women, but there's also a wage gap between white women and women of color.
Oh, yeah.
But we also see things like, the structures of the workplace haven't changed.
Right.
So that women have fought for the right to and won the right to be in the workplace and work. But it's like, well, who's going to watch your kids? And yeah. there's no answer to that, because the mainstream liberal feminist movement has been so focused on, we want women to have the right to choose. You should be able to choose if you want to go to work all day or if you want to stay home with your kids. It's like, these are my options. These are the two options.
Right.
Okay.
Well, also what's interesting is that, like, who ends up taking care of your kids? Generally, it's women of color.
Right.
And it is that thing. First of all, there's this way in which choice feminism, like we should have this choice, mm-hmm. gets very easily absorbed into a sexist system, so that then you see yep. women being like, this boob job is my choice. And you're
of
like,
Of course.
Okay.
One, it's like, I'm not trying to disparage women who make this choice, but the reality of the situation is a lot of women are like, I chose to leave my job and stay home for 3 years with my kids. Because my husband made more money than I did.
That's
right.
So it
only made sense that I would be the one to do it.
And how did that happen? Right.
Yeah. Or like, I felt more compelled to do it because society still kind of tells us that we have to. And my husband would have been a little bit humiliated to tell people he meets at dinner parties that he's a stay-at-home dad. It would be awkward and weird. Like, those pressures still exist and they're still influencing people's choices.
That's what's so crazy. We're talking about shows from the 80s and 90s. This is like 20, 30 years ago. And we have not made a lot of progress. I feel like that it's really,
especially
when Me Too is all about stuff that has happened in those intervening years. It's not about stuff that happened before that happened in the culture.
No, that's true.
And one thing that you're seeing a lot of limits of, and I'm especially talking about like in terms of white feminism, is that lately you see a lot of what a lot of Black writers call like white women tears.
Yes.
Where a lot of these white women and these white feminists are not able to acknowledge their own participation in a totally racist system. And lately there was a really interesting moment where there's a woman named Amy Siskind who has been doing a great job tracking the ways in which Trump's presidency has been destroying previously held political norms. Mm-hmm. Like that's what she's been doing every week. She's like, these are the norms that were destroyed this week. Well, Amy Siskind was also pre-Trump. And when Hillary and Obama were running against each other in the Democratic primary, was a PUMA. PUMA means party unity, my ass. And it was a group of women, mostly white women, mm-hmm. who when Obama was winning the primary against Hillary, said, fuck party unity. The fact that Obama won was some sexist bullshit. And they were fighting against supporting Obama.
Yeah. And they liked that McCain nominated Palin.
The actual policies that Obama was supporting were not as important to them as the fact that a woman was mm-hmm. going to be running, even if that woman's policies were terrible for women.
For everybody, but yeah, also for women.
And a journalist found that Amy Siskind had been a Palin supporter.
Yeah.
And Palin really, in a lot of ways, predated Trump in terms of bringing this sort of idiocracy.
So what happened on Twitter is that Imani Gandhi at Angry Black Lady started tweeting about this, pointing out that Amy Siskind's political history had some questions in it. It had some problems.
Yes. And Amy Siskind immediately was like, no, no, I didn't. No, I wasn't. No, she didn't say, hey, yes, I was part of this kind of PUMA thing. I said racist things about Obama. Like, and the thing is, these people have the fucking receipts.
Right.
They have footage of her on Fox News being like, yes, it's better for Palin to yeah. win. Meanwhile, Palin is like, no abortions ever. You're like, right, oh right. my God.
So I when I first saw this, and I saw some of her tweets that seemed to be pro-Palin, and I was like, well, if she felt that way, surely it wasn't a few tweets. So I did a little bit of a dive. And like, first of all, Amy Siskind was like the queen of the Pumas. She was like the leader of the pride, if you will. And it's not just that she was saying like, we should promote women candidates. She was calling Obama sexist. She wrote yeah. multiple pieces that explicitly accuse Obama of having a problem with women. She wrote a number of pieces that were like, should we give Sarah Palin a chance in 2012? And she would excuse away the anti-abortion thing and the other problems by suggesting
That's right.
that women who voted for Obama, this is the part where it really offended me. The women who voted for Obama only did so because they've been tricked into being one issue voters on abortion.
Oh!
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she's like, women who supported Hillary because she's a woman were accused of voting with their uteruses. But didn't women who voted for Obama because he's pro-abortion rights vote with their uteruses? Like,
oh,
she
God.
Wrote that, like, the paraphrasing, but she wrote that.
And I also want to mention one of the women who actually ended up in the middle of the storm because she was somebody who really called Amy Siskind out was Diane Lissa at mm-hmm. Diane Lissa. She's great.
Yeah, follow her.
Follow her. She's fantastic. But here's the thing that makes people go, oh, white feminism or oh, white women tears is mm-hmm. that when she's called out, she's like, I'm not racist. It actually reminds me of on Insecure on Issa Rae's show. Issa works for this like you know, helping kids in the inner city after school program. And the woman who runs the program obviously is a middle-aged white lady. And they have this meeting about how their like little symbol, their logo might need a refresh. And they're talking about how like the logo seems kind of racist because it's like this white hand holding a bunch of black children. And the woman who runs the organization is like, it can't be racist. It's my hand. And I feel like that to me is exactly the kind of white women tears.
Yeah.
You see it a lot with all of these white men who are like calling the police on like black people doing stuff.
Oh,
in
yeah.
In terms of Amy Siskind's inability to go, yeah, that was kind of racist of me. Like, was there sexism in the Obama administration? Sure. Like, obviously, sexism is there. And part of intersectionality and pre-intersectionality, you have bell hooks, of course, black woman, introducing this idea that you see a lot in a lot of 90s theory. You can't talk about sex without also talking about race and class. You can't talk about class without also talking about race and sex. You can't talk about race without also talking about class and sex. Like, these things all have to be thought about together, which is why the term intersectional exists. But part of that means that white ladies, who I think are very pained by the ways in which sexism has fucked up their lives, have a hard time acknowledging their own privilege.
So with Amy Siskind, who's like becoming our poster child for white feminism right now.
She's not the only one. She's just a really good example.
She's just a good example.
I'm sorry. She bears the weight of being a really good example for the problems of white feminism.
There you go. It's beyond just that she was like, it can't be racist. I'm not racist. I'm not racist. Like, she did do that, but it goes beyond that to the point of like, how dare you? Why are you attacking?
That's right.
Who are these people attacking me? You must be working for the other side. Because we are supposed to all be on the same side. And they use that to bludgeon women of color into silence by suggesting, like, we got to keep our eye on who the real enemy is. The real enemy is Trump and Trumpism. And if you attack me, that must mean you're trying to undermine my anti-Trump agenda.
That's right.
Yeah. That's bullshit, but that's what you get with this kind of white feminism.
And it's what it is it's profoundly defensive.
Yes.
I think that women who finally get to achieve some kind of power do not want that power challenged. And I know for myself, I'm going to like really lay it out there. One of my close colleagues is an African-American woman. And when we work together, she will call me on my shit and it hurts.
It's hard to hear. Yeah.
It's really hard to hear. But at the same time, I take it. Like, at the end of the day, if somebody wants to call me on my shit and it hurts, I'll take it. Even if there are ways in which I don't always entirely 100,000,000% agree, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt.
That's hard for people.
It's hard for me. I'm not saying that I'm like fucking expert at it. But there's this way in which at the end of the day, you have to stop and say, even if I think I have all of the best intentions in the world, I can still be wrong.
Yes.
And I can say, I had the best intentions, but I was still wrong on this. Or like, God, you're right. I wasn't thinking about this. I wasn't including this thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes I get frustrated because I do feel like white women get it worse from people of color and from women of color than white men do. I do. I do feel like that sometimes. At the same time, I think it's because when white women get called on their shit, they get so injured about it. Like, how can I be? I'm suffering too. And it's like, yeah, you're suffering in a really different way.
Yeah.
With a different layer of privilege. Like, there's this way in which I understand the way that white women tears are like sometimes even more annoying than white men.
Sure. There's a higher expectation for white women. If you're out there being like, I'm a feminist, I'm a social justice activist, well, then you have to live that. If you're out there saying you're an ally, you have to live that. So where white men maybe aren't getting called out, it's only because it's like, well, nobody expects shit from white men. They're fucking white men. So like, yeah, they're going to do what they're going to do. But if you're being a feminist, be a fucking feminist. Being a feminist means you're for women. Well, there's trans women. There's women of color. There's all different kinds of women that have, you know, there's working class women. You're going to get called out if you act like all women are you.
I think that sometimes what we're saying is you might have to cede some of your individual power, white lady, if you're going to be the person that you claim to be. And I feel like that's when you see this kind of like, no. Yeah. I don't want to cede my power. I don't want to cede my power. I fought for this power. And I think that that's where the kind of white feminism of the shows that we're talking about,
yes,
is that it was white women trying to take the place of white men instead of trying to change the world.
Yeah, bringing it back to the shows. In a lot of cases, if they're not trying to take the place of white men, they're trying to make do, survive, thrive in a male world.
Mm-hmm.
And not a lot of the shows would dive into the question of whether the structures they're being presented with are problems in and of themselves.
So I feel like part of this change is to say that you, white lady, might not get to be the star of the show.
Right.
And I think it is interesting that Murphy Brown is getting a reboot right now.
Yeah. And also I've heard Designing Women.
I think after that piece came out, they were like, oh yeah, she was good. We should give her some.
That will be really interesting to see how they handle those properties. You could make Consuela or whatever the character's name was actually be one of the Designing Women. How about that?
Oh, I mean, if you're going to do a show about Atlanta and the tensions, like what if the racial tension was part of the joke and the ongoing gag? And one of the Designing Women is black, and like whiteness is something that is always kind of at stake in the conversation. What if that's the tension all the time? Because it is. I do too. That's right. So we're going to see what happens when these white ladies get back in there. And we're going to see also if race is dealt with as a really truly integrated part of the show, or as just this kind of token thing. Just enough to say we're cool, but not enough to actually have to like give something up that we feel is giving. And even the fact that it would feel like giving up is the problem. It's not. And I feel like it should feel like gaining more.
We can do better. Do better, sitcoms. It's drunkometer time.
Look, I'm a 2. I'm really disappointed in myself. I thought that I was bringing a lot of booze. I'm a 2. I could totally drive right now.
All right. I'm a little disappointed because I was definitely hoping you would drive drunk.
And you?
I mean, I would place myself at a 4. I would say, I'm not super far gone, but I do have that like warm, relaxed thing that I'm pretty happy about.
Well, friends, we love our listeners and we've been so warmed by your emails, by your tweets, and we need you guys who are listening, because we know you're listening. We can see how many people are listening. There are like hundreds of you listening and we don't know your names, and that's a problem. So if you could please email us at saucepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us at saucepodcast. If you feel like Rebecca is a little overwhelming and a little intimidating, you can always just email me, MayaGarantz@gmail.com. You can find me on any of the socials at Maya Garantz, anywhere you're looking for Maya Garantzes.
Or if you really want to face up against my intimidating intellect, I promise I will be gentle. Challenge yourselves, people. at GynoStar on social media. You can find my webcomic at GynoStar.com. Also, don't forget to rate us on iTunes. If you're listening, it would only take a couple minutes and it would really help us out.
Also, write us a review. Don't just like rate us. Tell us exactly what is working for you.
Yeah.
Because we want to know.
Okay, until next week.
See you next week.
Adios, amoebas.